Chernobyl Nuclear Disaster Anniversary, Part 2.
The nuclear industry tries to convince all of us that nuclear reactors are really very safe. And the World Health Organization insists that Chernobyl's nuclear accident caused few deaths and had no lasting effect on the environment. So it takes many people, including a Bulgarian Greenpeace member who got hit by the radiation plume from Chernobyl when that accident happened, to make us understand.
Since Chernobyl in my country and in the whole area, the percentage of genetic diseases, stillborn babies, miscarriages, cancer, tumors, respiratory problems, thyroid problems, bone and blood problems are skyrocketing. It's epidemic. I talked to the director of the biggest, most specialized hospital in Bulgaria. She said that miscarriages and genetic illnesses in Bulgaria are almost like considered like a flu, like something that almost everybody experiences. And this is not normal and it's not okay.
When you hear something like that, you realize that you and I and everyone else are in that awful seat we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong.
This week, part two of our special reports on Chernobyl on the 39th anniversary of that nuclear disaster.
We'll hear from Bulgarian Chernobyl survivor Bonnie Kunova about the nuclear accident's impact on her and her not-yet-born children. From Dr. Timothy Mousseau, we'll learn about his research into mutations in Chernobyl's insects, birds, and small mammals.
The late Dr. Janet Sherman,
who edited the English edition of Dr. Alexei Yablokov's groundbreaking book, Chernobyl, Consequences of the Catastrophe for People and the Environment, provides powerful insights into the genuine impact of that disaster. There will be a brief interview with the late Dr. Yablokov from 2013,
and then an update on the recent damage to the new safe containment vessel, the protective structure that surrounds the highly radioactive remains of the Chernobyl reactors. A Russian drone strike blew a hole in the roof and set it on fire. And the results, given information that I learned 9 years ago but have never seen reported anywhere, are making for a worrisome situation. We'll have that at the end of this special Chernobyl anniversary report. Today is Tuesday, April 22nd, 2025, and here is this week's special, Chernobyl Anniversary, Part 2.
The Chernobyl nuclear power plant in Ukraine, in the Soviet Union, was the site of a catastrophic nuclear accident on April 26, 1986. An explosion and fire released massive quantities of radioactive particles into the atmosphere, where they spread over much of the Western USSR and Europe. Radioactive particles from Chernobyl still circle the Earth as part of the jet stream, where it continues to be brought down to Earth by rain and snow. The story of the accident and what it took to encase the Chernobyl facility in the first sarcophagus was told in chilling detail in the film The Battle for Chernobyl. The film is available on YouTube, and we'll have it up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 357. To create a more personal picture of Chernobyl's lasting effects on people and the environment, I spoke with Bonnie Kunova. She was a 16-year-old living in Sofia, Bulgaria, about 800 miles away from Chernobyl, when the accident began in 1986. She currently lives in the United States with her husband and three children.
When Chernobyl happened on April 26th of 1986, where were you living?
I was living in Sofia, the capital of Bulgaria. Bulgaria is a small country in the Balkan Peninsula, and typically on the maps of the Chernobyl fallout, it's colored in gray, like it wasn't affected. Unfortunately, the reason for that is because the government never allowed any tests and never any data has been released about the impact, but the impact definitely has been devastating.
You're living in Bulgaria. What, if anything, did you learn about Chernobyl when it happened?
When it happened, nobody of the ordinary people knew anything about it. It was kept as a deep secret, as the communist government at that time felt obligated to be loyal to the Soviet Union powers that be, and of course Soviet Union couldn't do anything wrong or make any mistake. Therefore, there was nothing going on, and not only we weren't told, but when there was some whispers in the air, the government, Bulgarian government, officially went on national TV and declared that there's no problem and we can eat spinach and lettuce and drink milk and be outside. And we actually mandatory, I was a teenage girl at that time, were forced to march in some communist rally on exactly the same day when there was a rain that was dragging down the nuclear hot particles, and basically the nuclear rain was raining upon us.
How soon after it happened did you start hearing the whispers that something was wrong?
Basically, besides occasional whisper, nothing really was declared until the fall of the communism in 1989.
So it was three years.
And a half, yeah.
During that time, were people aware of any changes, either in the food or in health or in children?
People observed numerous changes. The plants that spring all looked burned and yellow and gray and brown. Some of the annual vegetables, especially the most sensitive, like spinach and lettuce I mentioned, were also brown and dead, some of them just looking strange. Some of the lettuces actually grew huge, like 3-4 size times bigger than the usual size. The next few summers, I actually was working in a farming community, and I heard from local farmers that they have observed strange changes in their baby animals. Every spring, all of them have their baby goats and sheep and cows and horses. And then they had amazingly high number of animals, either stillborn, born with organs and limbs that are like multiple numbers, like 5 legs or 2 heads or just like missing parts. I actually remember particularly in 1988, I worked a little bit longer, so it happened that my birthday in September was, I was still working there, and the farmers were so sweet, they wanted to throw a party for me, and they actually killed a baby goat, and that goat had sex organs for female and male. And if that was a novel, that would be foreshadowing of the future problems, because I heard from a scientist that the different creatures have different time of responding to radiation, and more primitive or simple organisms mutate faster, obviously. At that time, I heard from a scientist that they expect the peak in the mutations in humans to occur 10 years after Chernobyl, which was exactly when my son was born. But apparently, that even wasn't the most dramatic peak, because according to the recent statistics, the problems and the mutations continue even in a worse way year after year. So we really don't know when the peak will be.
How were babies affected by this?
The babies that were born at that time had bone problems, skin problems, respiratory problems.
You were talking before we did the interview. You mentioned about a child that you knew who was born 3 days after Chernobyl happened.
Yeah, that was my doctor. My son's doctor daughter was born 3 days after Chernobyl. And even that doctor, who was a medical personnel and very intelligent woman, wasn't aware of what's going on. So she was exposing her daughter to the sun, which is traditional for the area. And then
this is part of the health for giving the baby,
yes,
vitamin
especially
D.
Especially that winter time in Bulgaria is dark and cold, so you do need that exposure. Yes, her daughter's bones were literally melted, and she needed support for the rest of her life.
Her bones were melted.
Yeah, they were so soft that they couldn't support her body ever.
And she survived?
She survived with normal, otherwise intelligent girl, but disabled for life.
Did the government continue to deny that there was anything wrong?
Absolutely. The government continued to deny. There was no comment at all. The food wasn't withheld, so people actually were encouraged to eat food that was definitely contaminated. While later on in the investigation, it turned out that the government itself had deliveries with charter airplanes from New Zealand, special food for them and their families, and their families were in underground shelters. But the ordinary people were actually sent to march on the streets for rallies and get all the exposure that was at that time the strongest at its peak. So, no, there was no officially released any information besides the talk among people and lots of jokes. Bulgarians like to joke on political topics.
Tell me some Chernobyl jokes.
Grandson is asking his grandfather, hey, grandpa, tell me what was it in Chernobyl at that time? And the grandfather answers, oh, nothing much, don't worry about it, and pats his grandson on both of his heads. Yeah, I know it's bad. We shouldn't laugh, but it's... So, yeah, the grandson got two heads. So, and unfortunately, that's the reality for that area. If you look at any documentary, you can see children with tumors as big as their heads or organs outside of their bodies. And unfortunately, it doesn't get better. If you look at the data for Russia and Ukraine and all these areas that were affected, still it doesn't get better. Still people have all of these problems.
Talk to me about what happened with your son.
When I turned 24, I got pregnant. My husband at that time was also a mountaineer and outdoor man, and he was exposed to the Chernobyl radiation even in a closer proximity to the explosion. And I was marching in that communist rally that was mandatory, unfortunately. You couldn't sneak out unless you wanted to get in a serious trouble. I was young and healthy. I have no history of genetic diseases in our family. Same with my ex-husband. But our son was born and immediately diagnosed with Down syndrome. And the day he was born, there were 42 or 3 kids in the hospital. 3 out of them were Down syndrome kids, which is extremely high ratio of Down syndrome for the normal population.
Right, the normal percentage is
those,
what?
Those are all young mothers. For that age group, the normal ratio, I believe, is 1 in 3,000, something like that. And Bulgaria used to be a clean country, and actually it was pretty low genetic diseases. At that time, with my son, there were 3 more babies in the hospital with Down syndrome. That was a huge tragedy for all these people, because on the top of it, the country wasn't prepared. There was no such frequency of problems, mental problems or genetic problems. So there was no system of support, no services available for them. And these kids were really, really victims.
So what is it that has shown up in your son?
Well, he's severely mentally retarded. He has heart defect and other problems that are related to the genetic disease, like weak muscles, weak joints, blood problems, stomach problems. Also, I'm diagnosed with thyroid problems, immune problems. Once in a while, tumors here and there, which are pretty benign. But all of this actually, according to doctors, is linked to the exposure to radiation, because there's no history of any of it in our family. And I'm a pretty healthy person. I also was a mountaineer. So all of these problems, actually, according to the medical authorities, are linked to Chernobyl. And actually, my son officially is labeled as environmental case by the governmental workers who actually try to get support for these kids. Even before I got a son with Down syndrome, I was very dedicated to the environmental movement. And I was very aware that we are not capable of controlling and using safely the nuclear power. So I was actually a fighter against it. We actually did protests every springtime, every 26th of April. We were giving black ribbons to the pedestrians in Sofia, and we were doing protests. And there was actually pretty fun rallies in which everybody was dressed as a mutant. So we were having fun with that. But given a chance to tell people one thing, I want to say this. I don't want to leave a message about story about some strange girl with a Slavic accent who had an unpleasant experience with the bad communist government, got screwed, her son got screwed, and then she somehow managed to come to America and get a little bit better help for her and her son. That's all great, but that's not really what I want to say. The communist governments were evil and they were capable of lying, but they are not the only government capable of lying. I'm afraid that in any situation, powers that be serve their buddies, the people with power and money. And if big money is involved in developing nuclear power in any country, the governments will cover for them, and they did cover, as we saw in the case of Fukushima. The information wasn't released. We still don't know what kind of impact that horrible event will have. I feel for the Japanese people, and I know that it has had impact on America too. So since Chernobyl, in my country and in the whole area, the percentage of genetic diseases, stillborn babies, miscarriages, cancer, tumors, respiratory problems, thyroid problems, bone and blood problems are skyrocketing. It's epidemic. I talked to the director of the biggest, most specialized hospital in Bulgaria, who happened to be somebody I know. She said that miscarriages and genetic illnesses in Bulgaria are almost like considered like a flu, like something that almost everybody experiences. And this is not normal, and it's not okay, and it's not easy. I myself actually lost a baby a few years ago, and this is a huge tragedy that some people maybe never recover from. And we shouldn't take it lightly. We shouldn't say, oh, that's the price for using nuclear energy. There are other alternative sources of energy. We really don't need to play with that extremely dangerous energy that we really don't know how to control and how to store the waste. And it's just really something that we should leave alone.
What are your thoughts about what's facing Japan as a result of Fukushima?
I'm seriously concerned about what will happen in 5 or 10 years with the kids who will be born at that time after Fukushima, the kids from parents who have been in the area, or the little ones who already have been exposed. Are they going to develop all kinds of cancers, tumors, headaches, bleeding? We really don't know. And I feel for them and I worry about them. And I don't think that that's how we should treat our future, our kids. Even if we are ready to play Russian roulette or Japanese roulette, we should give the chance to our kids to actually have a safe environment and enjoy their lives without having to deal with tumors and cancers and fear and pain and disabilities. Because even one kid growing with tumor or, like in case of my son, intellectual disability and heart defects, has huge impact. Their life is so much tougher and so much opportunities are taken away. It's like a curse upon them. They're really robbed. This is a robbery officially imposed to them. And even one kid is too much if we're talking about impact of such a negative event. What about million kids? What about million people? I've been told that most of the people who participated in the original cleanup are already gone.
Cleanup of Chernobyl.
What about the cleanup in Fukushima? I know that they basically sent people who were sent on a suicidal mission, people who knew that basically that's the end of them and maybe they were really willing to sacrifice themselves. But why do we need to pay that price? We have alternatives. We have alternative sources of energy. We can learn to use less energy. We can learn to be less of a consumerist. There's options. We don't have to be slaves to the nuclear power and sell ourselves so cheap to such a dangerous business.
That was Chernobyl survivor Bonnie Kunova. Professor Timothy Mousseau is an evolutionary biologist and faculty member of the Department of Biological Sciences at the University of South Carolina. Beginning in 1999, Professor Mousseau and his collaborators have explored the ecological, genetic, and evolutionary consequences of low-dose radiation in populations of plants, animals, and people inhabiting the Chernobyl region of Ukraine and Belarus. More recently, he initiated a second research program in Fukushima, Japan. This is an excerpt from our interview from Nuclear Hot Seat number 243, first posted on February 16, 2016.
What were some of your early findings from Chernobyl?
The first visit in 2000, we went out and found all of the barns, the old dairy farms that we could find in and out of the zone. We snuck inside the zone at the time. At the time, the exclusion zone wasn't really as high security as it is now, and so it was easy to sort of zip in and zip out with nobody ever catching you. And so we found a number of the old dairy farms that still had barn swallows in them, inside the zone, outside the zone, as well as in areas a fair distance away that were much cleaner, less radioactive, and started catching all the birds we could catch. And the first discovery was quite striking. Many of the birds living inside the exclusion zone, or right on the border of the exclusion zone, had patches of little white feathers on them. You know, nothing really striking, no three-headed monsters or anything like that. But these birds were extremely unusual. They were pale to begin with, but they also had these patches, what we've been calling partial albinos. There are other names for this phenomenon, but everybody sort of understands partial albinism when you say it. And this was much higher in the areas of high radiation. There are a few birds in the cleaner areas that show this, but very, very few relative to the hot areas. So that was sort of the first observation. We came back each year to these same farms to follow these same birds. And the beauty of barn swallows is that they'll actually come back to the same barn, the same nest, as long as they're alive once they start breeding. And so we put little bands on their legs so we could actually track their survival from one year to the next. We could see how many eggs they were laying and how well their babies were doing. And we could take a little blood from them so that we could look for genetic damage and antioxidant levels. And we figured out how to get a little sperm sample from the males so we could look at how well their reproductive materials performed. And all of this started to add up to an interesting story after a couple of years. First, we noticed that males in the more radioactive areas were showing sperm that was either deformed or not particularly active, not particularly good at doing its job. That was the first sort of clue that fertility might be an issue for these birds. Then we started to notice that many of the birds had other strange abnormalities, physical abnormalities, tumors on their heads, tumors on their feet and on their rear ends and sometimes on their wings, just sort of abnormalities that you never see in a normal population. And so all of this kind of added up to the fact that these birds were not doing particularly well. They were living half as long as birds in clean areas. They were having fewer offspring. The male fertility was lower. Recently, we've also shown that they have higher levels of cataracts in their eyes. It's just a plethora of negative consequences of the exposure to radiation. That was the beginning of all of this.
And you go back to Chernobyl still every year to do the updates on the bird population?
You know, we do. We've been tracking the barn swallows every year. And, you know, every year we try to add a little experiment to the pot so that we learn a little bit more about what might be going on. The fact that we've been doing it for 15 years straight, this will be the 16th year for these populations, gives us a lot of statistical power for the sorts of questions we're interested in. Some years we've been putting little dosimeters on the legs of these birds for the last 4 years. And so now we have a really good idea of how big a dose they're getting as they fly around, and that's never been documented before. We keep following these birds. But in 2003, 2004, we realized that barn swallows were great, but people, you know, had broader interests than just barn swallows. Well, what we realized actually was that there was this growing interest in what was going on in the Chernobyl zone. We weren't just doing it to satisfy our own curiosity at that point. We realized that other folks were interested, and the questions that we were getting were, this is happening to the barn swallows. Is it happening to the other birds? What's happening to the insects? What's happening to the mammals? And so we started to branch out into a few other areas. We brought in other experts from other universities to collaborate with to help us in some of the systems we had less experience with. And so now we've been working on the entire bird community. I guess 3-4 years ago, we added a group from Finland who are mammal specialists, small mammal specialists, and we've been trapping rodents in Chernobyl as well as in Fukushima, and learning an awful lot about other components of the ecosystem in the area.
Any results that you can report as yet?
One of the great things about working with, you know, some of the best scientists, some of the most accomplished scientists from around the world on these projects is that, you know, we're getting a lot done. We've published about 80 papers in the last 10, 11 years on Chernobyl and Fukushima, and folks can go to my website and get them all. But the latest results, we published a paper last week, actually, it came out. It was one of our first papers on the small mammals, the rodents of Chernobyl, where we document an increase in the rate of cataracts in the eyes of the females. You know, we published a paper on the birds of Chernobyl 2 or 3 years ago, showing again that the cataracts in the eyes were much higher levels in the more radioactive areas. Now we're seeing this also in the rodents. And so this provides substantial support for the hypothesis that, you know, this is the radiation that's causing this. Folks tend to, you know, if they can, they will throw out some objections to some of these ideas. They'll suggest that it's not due to the radiation, it's due to something else. And they'll have a long list. But clearly, the more results we have that run in parallel among different systems in Chernobyl, but also amongst the same systems in both Chernobyl and Fukushima, when we find the same kinds of results in both places, the only explanation that makes any sense is that it's the result of the radiation exposure. And so that's why we've invested so much into replicating most of our Chernobyl work in as much as we can in Fukushima as well over the last 5 years now.
Dr. Timothy Mousseau.
We'll return to this week's special feature on the 39th anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster in just a moment. But first, Chernobyl was a nuclear reactor accident. No blinding flash, no fireball, no mushroom cloud. But in terms of its destructiveness, it was its own kind of nuclear bomb. Uncontrolled radiation releases from the exploded reactor were carried in a cloud of fallout as far away as northern Scandinavia, Belarus, Germany, and much of Western Europe. And even after 39 years, its radioactivity is still, well, active, still wafting around the world, and will be for hundreds, if not thousands, of years, continuing to compromise health, safety, and the DNA of all living things. Yet the nuclear industry insists that reactors are safe. Oh, that was Russian technology. Ignore Fukushima and Three Mile Island and all the leaks and cracks and smaller accidents that put us all at foreseeable risk. Just keep giving them money, money, money. Now for small modular nuclear reactors. Sounds cute, doesn't it? Never mind that none has ever been built, no designs have been approved, and small refers to the amount of electricity they generate in proportion to the amount of fuel that they use and the waste they create. It's a nuclear Ponzi scheme. And we the people are the ones being tricked into not only accepting and supporting it, but embracing it. And that is why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. We don't buy into the nuclear industry's well-financed PR propaganda bovine feces machine. Our stories are vetted, verified, sourced from reputable world-class experts and frontline activists. But we can't keep this show going without your help. I'm talking about donations. So if you're grateful for the information you get here, show me. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and follow the prompts. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that anything you donate is tax deductible. So don't wait. Go now to nuclearhotseat.com and donate. Make a difference. And know that I am deeply grateful that you are listening and that you care. Now back to this week's special feature, part 2 of the 39th anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster.
The late Dr. Janet Sherman is well known for her work with epidemiologist Joseph Mangano on analyses of data after Fukushima that indicated a spike in U.S. infant mortality and hypothyroidism. She also edited the English translation of Alexei Yablokov's groundbreaking book, Chernobyl, Consequences of the Catastrophe for People and the Environment, which translated more than 5,000 articles published around the world on the impact of that disaster. This interview with Dr. Sherman was originally from Nuclear Hot Seat in April of 2013.
A lot of people have saying that when we talk about Chernobyl and Fukushima, that we're scaring people. and I say, but, you know, not everything was tested. Domestic and wild animals, fish, birds, trees, plants, fungi, insects, everything were tested. Many, many things were tested. And all of them showed adverse effects after Chernobyl. And none of them are sitting on a psychiatrist's couch, you know.
So it's not psychological when no. there are mutations in butterflies and animals and there's radiation showing up in the boars and things like that.
Yes, that's correct. And also, my colleague Tim Mousseau has been to both Chernobyl about 25 or 30 times, and he's been to Fukushima a number of times, and they're finding the same changes in the birds and the insects and the trees in Fukushima as they are finding in Chernobyl. They, too, are not sitting on a psychiatrist's couch, so we know that these changes are real, and they're persistent.
In terms of Chernobyl, what are some of the changes? Certainly there was catastrophic exposure in the early days, but as it has progressed, what has been showing up now that we are, 27 years now away from the anniversary of it having happened?
In Belarus, one of the biggest concerns is 80% of the children are not considered well.
How would they define not well?
Well, of various immunological problems, respiratory problems, birth defects, low IQ. And now this is, would be, you know, if some woman was pregnant during Chernobyl, this would be going into the third generation. You know, this is, would be a grandmother, you know, if she was like 25. Now we're talking about probably a third generation that is damaged as a result of, and in Belarus, which is, you know, having a terrible time, and economically it's in tough straits.
So the impact genetically was not only on the first generation that got exposed to it, but you're saying that these are permanent mutations that have happened or genetic changes that have happened that are being passed down through the generations in Belarus.
Well, not only in Belarus, but other places as well. I think somebody did, I can't remember who the researcher was, did 20-some generations of wild voles, V-O-L-E-S, those little creatures that look like a mouse, and they found that the genetic changes were permanent throughout all 20 generations.
I've wondered, with the genetic impact, if there are 20 generations of voles, they've just changed a little bit, maybe they've adapted to it. Is such a thing possible, adaptation to the radiation?
Well, there are people who think that there is such a thing, but I don't really know. I don't think so.
How does the research that's been done on Chernobyl relate to Japan? Is it really a vision of what they are facing as a result of Fukushima? Is it worse in Japan? Is it happening more quickly or more slowly there?
Biology, chemistry, and physics are pretty fixed. If you look at the periodic table of elements, and you know that strontium-90 is being released, and you know it's in the same category as calcium, you know it's going to go to the teeth and bones. If you look at cesium-137, it's in the same family as potassium, and it goes to all the muscles and the glands. So it's not a surprise that these elements will have an adverse effect on living creatures, whether it's a plant, an animal, or a human. You can't change biology, and we know that it takes a certain period of time for an isotope to dissipate. It takes approximately 10 half-lives. So if you're talking about strontium-90 and cesium-137, they're about 30 years half-life. So you're talking about 3 centuries, 10 times 3, that's 3 centuries. And this is immutable. These are things that you simply cannot change. We know these things, and we've known them since the 40s. This is not new information. To say that, well, we really don't know what's going to happen in Fukushima is somehow or other either wishful thinking or trying to fool the public, because once these isotopes are released, there's no getting them back.
In terms of the human genetic damage that has been taking place, does it get worse through the generations? Is there any way to recover from it?
I doubt it. We do know, for instance, that the children born to the men and women who worked as, quote, liquidators, they were the people who cleaned, actually conscripted and brought in, there were over 700,000 of them. We know that the children born to these people turned out to be unhealthy. Many simply just died, and there were a high number of miscarriages or abortions. just as a result of the children were so defective. So is there a way to reverse it? I don't think so. Biology is, you know, pretty much progresses along a line, and it's hard to change it.
For those who have survived, at least on the surface, from Chernobyl, does it look like there will be long-term survival? I mean, what we're facing here, I mean, this is existential, but it's also true that with radiation, with the long life of it, and with its impact, it does seem as though what we're dealing with is the potential of certainly a change in the nature of life on Earth, if not a potential ending for it. Does it look like the people who have been impacted by radiation are going to be able to survive in the long run through the generations, or are we a piece of biological machinery that's in the process of wearing down to zero?
Well, I hate to say it, but I think it's correct. It is wearing down. And if you've got people who've got immunological abnormalities and kids who are born with either birth defects or hypothyroidism, as my associate Joe Mangano and I reported last month, these are people who are going to have to be on the hypothyroid babies are going to have to be on thyroid medication the rest of their lives. So if you can't get the medication, you don't have the money, or you don't have the resources, or you don't know that you need it, then it's a disaster. Thinking that we can release large amounts of radiation into the biosphere and escape any harm is foolish. Whether it changes the wheat or the corn or, you know, other plants, we don't know. But it may make things much harder to grow, and we may be faced with very serious problems. I mean, what are you going to eat if you're in Japan and you rely on vegetables, which in around the Fukushima area was a very big agricultural area? And if you eat lots of fish and all the fish is contaminated, what are you going to eat? This is very, very serious concern.
In terms of exposure to radiation, what is the biggest difference in relation to internal versus external exposure?
Oh, that, of course, that is the critical one, because the nuclear industry keeps saying, well, it's no more than flying across the country in a jet plane. But the whole issue is the taking into the body isotopes that go to various parts of the body, whether I-131 to the thyroid and cesium to soft tissue, including the breasts, and strontium-90 to the teeth and bones. This is the issue. Once they're taken into the body, they release, you know, alpha or beta particles and cause harm.
Is there any way that we know of to remove radiation from the body once it has been taken in, either ingested or breathed in or come in through a cut or a wound?
The only research that I know of was done after Chernobyl, where they used apple pectin to decrease the levels of cesium-137. Now, whether they're doing this in Fukushima or not, I don't know. But it did seem to lower the levels of cesium-137. And getting children away from the milieu where they're eating contaminated food on a daily basis seems to help. Children were taken to the United States and other countries and seemed to improve when they were away for, you know, 6 weeks or 2 months. They used a gamma measuring chair so the kids could sit in and measure the levels of gamma radiation that was mostly coming from the cesium. And they found that the kids' levels did decrease. But what do you do when you go back and you start eating the local food again?
Is there any way known to remove the radiation from the food or from the water?
Well, I understand that Japan has been trying to remove radiation from the water and then storing the water. And where they're putting the radiation they removed, I have no idea. But it turns out they're trying to store the water in plastic-lined pools. And, of course, we know that that's not going to work very well. And it's now running out into the ocean. And we're finding that even fish and clams and seaweed off the coast of North America are contaminated.
What, to your way of thinking, is the best way to protect ourselves?
I think the only way to protect ourselves is we have to close these nuclear power plants. We've had, you know, the meltdown of Chernobyl, then of Fukushima, which is still really, it hasn't stopped. It's still releasing enormous amounts of radiation. It was about 4 days after Fukushima happened, when Alexei Yablokov, the senior author of the book Chernobyl, came to the United States and stayed with me for 5 days. And he said, quote, Fukushima is much worse than Chernobyl. And because, you know, the country is small, the population is very concentrated. The Fukushima area was a major agricultural area, and there's no place to escape. Now, Ukraine was big, and it wasn't a major, you know, it was a big grain growing area, but it wasn't small farms. He was here just before the Caldecott conference, and he said, there's going to be another meltdown. I said, where? He said, well, I don't know where, but there just statistically speaking, just by chance, yes, there's going to be another meltdown. Now, there's about 400 reactors in the world and 100 in the United States. We don't know which one is going to go down, but just because of the age of these and the fact that accidents happen, it's going to be another one. And what are we going to do then?
How did you come to work with Alexei Yablokov on the book, on this cornerstone book on Chernobyl?
Well, it's like everything in my life. It was by accident. It must be about 15 years ago, a friend of mine had heard Alexei speak in New York, and he said, Janet, you've got to meet this man. You've got to hear him speak because he's going to be in Washington next week. So I went to hear him speak, and it was stunning. I mean, he was so interesting, and I went up and introduced myself and talked to him, and we got to visiting, and then we kept in touch. And I think it was in 08 he came here and brought me the Chernobyl book in Russian, which, of course, I can't read Russian. And he said, we need to get this into English. And I kind of naively said, well, I can edit it. And I figured it would take me, you know, 4 or 5 months. Well, it took 14 months. And he said, we have no money. And I said, well, that's okay. You know, I'm retired and my husband has died, so I've got time to do something like this. So I did it. And that's how I happened to be the editor, just by, you know, chance.
And how has that book impacted the world? What is the importance of it to researchers, to medical personnel, to governments out there?
There was, you know, an enormous criticism of the book by the nuclear industry as soon as it came out.
Of course.
But it encompasses over 5,000 articles written by researchers from all over the world. And it's the first time that literature that was published by people in Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine has been translated and available to English-speaking people. But there's articles in there from Greece and Israel and Germany, Italy, Sweden, everywhere. I think the big thing is that it encompasses what has happened to so many species, not just humans, but so many species. You can't ignore the fact that this is worldwide, although concentrated more in Europe than it is in the United States or Canada.
Now, here's a question that I've had for a long time, and that is that it seems that cancer used to be a relatively rare disease, but that since approximately the mid-40s, and if we think 1945 from Trinity through Hiroshima and Nagasaki, those were the first atmospheric releases of nuclear radiation and the radionuclides. Since that time, through the years, it seems that cancer has first been slowly growing in its rate and now exploding exponentially to the point where 41% of us are expected to get cancer in our lives. While it may seem to my naive and non-scientific eyes that there is a direct correlation, as a doctor, as somebody who is experienced in this, what for you is the correlation between the increase in radionuclides and the ever-expanding rate of cancer in the world?
I think there's a direct relationship. We know that cancer is not randomly distributed in any population, none. A great deal of research has been done showing increase in cancer in proximity to nuclear power plants. A number of very good articles have been reported from Germany about children and leukemia in proximity to nuclear power plants in Germany. We also know that Busby's work shows an increase in cancer around the plants in the British Isles. My colleague Joe Mangano did a study of thyroid cancer in the United States. And men, women, blacks and whites, the highest cancer rate for thyroid cancer in the United States, guess where?
You tell me.
Eastern Pennsylvania. Yeah, downwind from Three Mile Island.
Oh, my God.
And southern New Jersey. This is not data that we generated. This is governmental data. And the study that we just released on hypothyroidism in newborns in the United States is based on governmental data. And we are using state and federal data. The federal government is doing nothing. The Congress, as we know, is probably never going to do anything. So we have people wringing their hands, dealing with sick family members. And we don't know everything that causes cancer, but we know a number of them we could do something about, and we do nothing about it.
You know, this is stunning information.
I mean, we're killing ourselves.
Right. So if you had a message that you wanted to get out, I mean, your information is superb. You've been doing this for years. If you had a key message to put out, what would that be?
Would be, say, to mobilize every neighborhood. I mean, it's useless right now, I think, to start petitioning Congress or the president or anything like that. I would say in your neighborhood, mobilize your neighborhood to close any nuclear power plant that's within 200 miles of where you live and get them closed down. And even when they're closed down, there's problems because you have fuel pools with these, quote, spent rods, which, unless they're kept underwater, are going to catch fire and release massive quantities of radiation. You know, this needs to be closed down, but unless people speak up and march in the streets and scream and holler, I don't think anything will happen. How did we get the vote for women? We marched in the streets. How did we get civil rights? We marched in the streets. And how did we get the Vietnam War stopped? The only way is to get the citizenry involved. And most people are just passive and are not doing anything.
Either that or they're so overwhelmed by the details of daily life that they don't have any extra energy to put to this invisible, though ultimately life-threatening, power source that is out there.
You're absolutely right, particularly if you're taking care of a family member with cancer or a child with cancer. You're overwhelmed.
And sometimes I just want to curl up in a ball, suck my thumb, and weep because I don't have any children, and that's the decision I made after Three Mile Island. But for the children who are out there, what kind of a future are we creating for them? What kind of a future do we have on the planet? And who are these people who think that by this short-term, greedy, irresponsible behavior, they're going to have a future line as well? What makes them think that they're immune to the consequences?
You're right. You're absolutely. I don't get it. I mean, I really don't understand how people can do this. You know, there's the Hippocratic Oath that physicians take, and I took it years ago. First, do no harm. And I think this, you know, if this were given to people who are managing the nuclear plants and the whole industry, maybe they'd think differently about it. I don't know. But when you see such widespread damage worldwide, I don't know how we can, as a human species, continue to even use nuclear power. We don't need it. It only provides about 20% of our power. If you fly across this country and you see all the flat roofs that you could put solar on, and then you don't have to deal with long-distance distribution lines, you can put it on the roof of a Walmart or a Safeway or any kind of a store, feed the power right down into the building, or wind, which is now becoming very useful. I don't see why we have to have a nuclear, except that it supports an enormous industry. And there's a tremendous amount of money there in that industry.
And also it supports the military-industrial complex because it provides the raw material for the bombs.
Exactly. Why are we exercised about Iraq building a nuclear power plant or North Korea having one? Well, because every nuclear power plant can produce the fuel to make a bomb.
Ah, we are in such a mess.
I know. That's why I'm saying people, if people want to do something, mobilize your neighborhood. Just mobilize people and say, we've got to stop this madness.
Dr. Janet Sherman. The study on hypothyroidism in children born on the west coast of North America after Fukushima can be found on the Radiation and Public Health website, radiation.org. We'll also link at nuclearhotseat.com, episode 357. I was honored to meet
Dr. Alexei Yablokov at Dr. Helen Caldicott Symposium on the Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Disaster, held in New York in March of 2013. Dr. Yablokov was environmental advisor to the Russian President Yeltsin and to the Gorbachev administration, as well as the co-founder of Greenpeace Russia. He passed away in January of 2017, but we have this remembrance from 11 years ago. Dr. Yablokov has a thick accent, but I encourage you to listen closely to this brief interview, where he expresses the need for independent international testing of all nuclear power reactors. Tell us briefly what you shared with the audience about what Chernobyl has to tell us about Fukushima.
Both Chernobyl and Fukushima became more clear. Show us, if we count the consequences for public health, it looked like the existing norm and regulation, official norm and regulation, not enough to protect people from negative consequences of irradiation. It's a big question why. I try to explain it. We have a lot of explanation why. Because it's impossible to catch all radionuclide. It's impossible to precisely estimate irradiation during first days, first hours, first weeks, when level of irradiation 100,000 million times less than it will be. But as a result of this, all of these difficulties, the existing norm, it existing safety regulation, it's not enough safety. This is the main lesson from Chernobyl, and the same, we have absolutely the same situation in Fukushima. Also, it's impossible to trust official declaration. Official declaration and industry representative, the logic to diminish any consequences. So what we have to be answer for normal people, for society. We have no right to believe official declaration and have no right to believe, to trust industry. What consequences for society? It means that we need to create independent system for check radiation. Independent because we have now a lot of nuclear power plant all over the globe. It means that every country, every society situated around the nuclear power plant have to have some possibility for independent measurement level of radiation. Japanese experience in Fukushima show that it's possible. It was impossible in Soviet time in Chernobyl because it was secrecy, no money. So KGB, local KGB follow the every people who measurement. But in Fukushima, society, Japanese society show that it quite possible to organize independent from state, independent from industry, system for monitoring of radiation. It's a key problem, maybe key problem for safety life even in the United States. Because, look, 2 years ago, some German scientist friend of mine show that even normal working nuclear power plant in some part of year released much more radionuclide than it average report average. Average is very dangerous. Average is the average temperature for hospital. It not protect person, not protect individual. We need monitoring every day because, for example, every nuclear power plant take spent nuclear fuel and put, and during this operation, normal release from nuclear, enormous. But when it average for a year, nothing dangerous, but it will be dangerous for people who happen just now, just in this place, when this operation released. So we need some independent monitoring. It's also a lesson from Chernobyl, lesson from Fukushima.
The late Dr. Alexei Yablokov from 2013. Now here's an update as of April 2025. And the primary source for this is an article by Kim Baker in the New York Times of March 25, 2025. Chernobyl was left as a deadly radioactive husk of a destroyed reactor site.
to limit its deadly radiation releases. Within 24 days of the explosion, Russia started building an enclosure, which they called a sarcophagus, an emergency building encasing the most dangerous area around Unit 4. The sarcophagus locked in 200 tons of radioactive lava-like corium, 30 tons of highly contaminated dust, and 16 tons of uranium and plutonium. This was at best a temporary measure, and by 1996, the structure had deteriorated to the point where numerous stabilization measures were required. The new safe containment structure was designed with the primary goal of confining the radioactive remains of Reactor 4 for 100 years. It also aimed to allow for a partial demolition of the original sarcophagus from inside the structure, a process expected to take years, if not decades. It was constructed 590 feet, or 180 meters, west of Reactor 4, and slid into place on the equivalent of railroad tracks. The new safe confinement is so large it's visible from space, and as of its implementation in 2016, is the world's largest movable land-based structure. Sliding the structure along foundation rails was a difficult process, taking more than 2 weeks, and plans have continued for removing the radioactive remains inside starting later this year. But on February 14, a drone with a high-explosive warhead punched a hole in the steel shell. While the initial fire was quickly put out, a waterproof membrane inside the insulation of the arch burned and smoldered for almost 3 weeks. Emergency workers had to work in mountain climbing equipment to knock more holes into the shield's outer layer, hunting for the fire, and spraying water inside a structure designed to stay dry to prevent corrosion. On March 7, Ukraine declared the fire officially extinguished, and radiation levels outside Chernobyl are still normal, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency and Ukrainian nuclear regulators. But repairs could take years. Sean Burney, a nuclear specialist at Greenpeace who visited the damaged reactor at Chernobyl after the drone attack, said, "The reason the international community spent so much money and time building this structure is because they know the scale of the threat radiologically inside. It's an enormous intellectual achievement to build something that could protect Europe, Ukraine, and the world from what's inside. And now the Russians have basically blown a hole in it, both physically and metaphorically." The IAEA said the shell's confinement function had been compromised and that the structure needed extensive repair efforts. Several experts have said the entire shell might have to be removed, dismantled, and replaced, with the head of the Chernobyl Operations Department saying, "Full restoration of the facility is practically impossible. To bring it as close to possible to its original state, well, that would require hundreds of millions of dollars." There is one additional set of factors that did not show up in the New York Times article, something that I was made aware of several years ago, right before the new safe confinement structure was rolled into place. In a private conversation I had with someone who worked with the engineers at the Chernobyl site, she related something they'd been talking about privately, that there were potential problems with the structure they had not taken into account, including with global warming. The permafrost underlying the structure has been melting and softening. The structure weighs more than 31,000 tons. And even back in 2016, there were concerns that the weight on the softened ground could potentially lead to subsidence, putting stress on the structure, leading to potential cracks, misalignment of parts, and structural vulnerabilities. Also with subsidence, the rails along which the building traveled could be warped, making it difficult, if not impossible, to reverse the passage of the building if necessary. At the time, they were debating whether the building could be successfully moved into place. So with the uncertain future of the heavily damaged new safe confinement building, the legacy of Chernobyl continues to threaten the world as an ongoing nuclear radiation disaster with no end. Nuclear Hot Seat will provide you with updates as they occur. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, April 22nd, 2025. To get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, you can sign up by going to nuclearhotseat.com and filling out the yellow opt-in box. That way, you'll never miss a single episode. And remember, If you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Anything helps. And as always, we're grateful for your support. This is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, a nuclear accident anywhere is a nuclear accident everywhere. That is your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.